Hello and welcome. This is Gino and Julia Barbaro of Barbaro 360 and the Julie and Gino podcast. How are we doing, baby?
Good.
You ready?
Excellent. Oh, yeah.
We've got a great guest today. Let me read you his bio. It's Dr. Charles Chafin. He's a psychologist and financial planning expert, co-founder of Money and Risk Inventory and the Psychology of Financial Planning Programs. He coaches advisors. He's authored 9 books, including works with Brad Klontz, and has led research at CFP Board, the Wharton School, Columbia University, and Iowa State University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Charles. How are we doing?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Where do we start? I'd like to start with your background, how you got to become a financial planner from being in the psychology world.
Yeah, financial planning kind of found me. I finished my doctorate and it focused mainly on education and cognitive psychology. I got a call from a recruiter the recruiter called it CPF Board. And I had no idea what really financial planning was, and it wasn't even the proper name. So, well, you should take this. They're looking for somebody to come in and work in their education and research area. And gradually during my time there, I had access to lots of planners and lots of other scholars. And at that time, my time there, the robo-advisor element started coming in the mid-teens. And so we started building out this element of, at the time we called it client psychology, of a book that I did for CFP Board in that space. And it just gradually kind of evolved. It became more and more important. And, you know, it is, as an aside to that, I guess, we see as technology comes, the transactional side of whether it's planning or the transactional side of really anything has become automated. Human mm-hmm. beings aren't the gatekeepers of transactions. Transactions just happen because of technology, whether it's the internet, whether it's AI, and whatnot. And what that's created is a real opportunity. The opportunity is that it's really about the human to human element, right? Mm-hmm. It's about connecting, individuals connecting. And I started my research on attention. You know, our attention is our most valuable resource we can give to someone. And so when you have that, whether it's in planning, whether you have that in any other field, it's incredibly powerful. I left CFP 3 years ago. I have a faculty position, but building MRI and work a lot with advisors and helping them better understand their clients and manage client biases and whatnot.
I saw my wife wrote down a note, so I'm going to let her ask the question.
Well, no,
her note was, why is this guy going on and on at the first question? This is going to be 5 hours at this point.
I know she wrote down because I wrote down the same thing.
You did.
It's attention,
we did.
Baby.
We wrote
see
the
that? Because I don't. I get attention.
Word.
Yes. And why did you write down attention?
Well, it's just interesting, the two of you, before we're even getting on here. It's just the in-depth conversation of finance and money and all this. And sometimes it's the basics in life that we don't want to put the effort into. And that's just giving attention to somebody and listening to them and hearing them and learning about them. And we want to make it. And, you know, my husband was in real estate, teaching people real estate and why certain people buy, why they don't. And it's so interesting to get into the person's mind and to learn about them a little bit. So I kind of want to go on. I don't have a question. I just want to talk about that a little bit.
Well, actually, when she hears money, she sort of glazes over. So her attention
span. The word financial advisor, I glaze over. Okay. Money, I'm good with now.
You're good with money now. Yeah, baby.
I have a new awareness since we've done the money coaching.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I guess on the attention side first, I mean, it is, we have more things that are pushing and pulling our attention. We live in an attention economy. That is, there's an entire currency that really is focused on our attention, because without our attention, without any of that, you can't love, you can't spend, you can't experience. None of that happens without you're getting attention first. I mean, you could think about whatever cause it is that you're devoted to. If your attention's not devoted on it as being important, or whatever behaviors you're going to do to help that cause, without your attention, it's really irrelevant. It really is the gatekeeper. We call it it's a gatekeeper to our consciousness of what we are. And so nowadays, within the past 10 years, with iPhones and screens in front of us, it's been very, very expensive for individuals on a person-to-person level to really have those connections. And so I always talk about, you know, the most important gift you can give anyone, even if it's for 10 minutes, is your undivided attention. Mm-hmm. Focus solely on not only what they're saying, but how they're saying it, where their eyes are going, and whatnot, and really being really devoted to that.
Yeah.
I want to dive into this MRI, not the magnetic resonance imaging machine, but the money and risk inventory, because you said MRI so quick, and I think it's a really cool tool. Can you dive into that for us?
Yeah, appreciate that. So we started MRI, the money and risk inventory, is kind of a culmination of decades of research amongst the three of us that built it. Brad Klontz is one of the people. John Grable built the risk component of money and risk inventory, and then my work as well. And so it kind of does two things. It first of all looks at risk tolerance from a behavioral perspective. So not just, you know, thinking about if you have individuals that are clients that are listening or watching, or even advisors, it's not really looking at what is a stated preference, what people say. You know, what people say about anything is not necessarily going to be accurate, right? For lots mm-hmm. of different reasons. And a lot of those reasons aren't because they're deceptive. It's because they're trying to, you know, if you take a survey, they're trying to tell the surveyor what they think they want to hear, or maybe they're, you know, trying to show a little bit more bravado when it comes to risk tolerance or many other things. But really looking at, okay, from a behavioral perspective, the best way we can figure out what someone's going to do in a future scenario is find out what they did in a similar scenario in the past, right? So that's mm-hmm. a real big part of that. And then on the financial psychology side, so all the work that Klontz and I do in our education programs for advisors, we're in 100 universities with that program. And we have our new book, a second edition of our book out. All of that now is part of the MRI assessment. So a client can go in and take those questions, find out about how much FOMO they have. Are they an overconfident investor? Do they have some element of anxiety? Do they feel like they don't have control over their finances? And what MRI does is it sends a report to the advisor saying, okay, here's what the client is exhibiting. Here's where to start that conversation, so that you know there's a million different directions that an advisor could go with a client. This is narrowing it down, saying, okay, there's a red, yellow, and green. Red means this is a priority item. They're really, really exhibiting high levels of anxiety. Talk about it, and here's some mm-hmm. things to consider. So that's come out. We're in three countries now with advisors and firms using it. It's a year old and it's expanding rapidly. So we're real excited about it.
How long ago do you think that came into vogue? Because I would say 20, 30 years ago, most financial advisors would say, here's the playbook, 60, 40 stocks, you know, 40 bonds. You know, if you do this for the next 20 years, you save, you'll be able to retire. They didn't take into account this psychological, this behavioral aspect. When do you think that became more relevant or more popular?
I would say within the past 10 years. I think there's a couple of different factors that caused it. One is, I already alluded to the robo-advisor element, that transactional uh-huh. side that disappeared about in the middle of the last decade. So it's a play for relevance for the advisor. What is it that an advisor is going to do that's going to be better than something that they could, that a client could get on AI or whatnot? Mm-hmm. And it really is a coaching element.
Yes.
So coaching and being able to understand what are the biases that the client has and help address those when it comes to everything from goal setting to any other parts of the financial plan. And so really, I think that the shift in advisors' competencies are coming in the sense of, let's talk about these specific things. Let's get more goals. And I'm adding one more element to that is, you know, we have roughly between, depending on what research you look at, 30 to 40% of this country says they don't have one person to talk to. They don't have one person to confide in. So for an advisor, there's two sides to that. First of all, it's an immense opportunity that you could be that one person that to say, what is it that your retirement's going to look like, right? On the other side of that, it's a real challenge for an advisor to say, okay, how do I go about starting that process with someone who's ever been asked that before? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a sad mm-hmm. metric too. And it's mm-hmm. it is tied a lot to what we were talking about when it comes to our attention and social media and all those different things that we're looking for, you know, we're looking for that element of companionship from things that aren't going to give it back to us, right? Mm-hmm. We're devoting, you know, in some cases we're seeing 3 and 4 hours of social media time, but that comes at the expense of something, and usually it comes mm-hmm. at the expense of our relationships. So as the profession is evolving, and clients too, by the way, are wanting decisions to happen faster, that everybody has a short time frame. We want to really move. We're all impatient in some way. So, you know, what MRI does and what all these factors come and say, hey, let's get to it now. Let's mm-hmm. not take, you know, firms don't want to take 4 meetings to have a discovery session with a client. They want to shrink that down. And clients do too. They want to get to it, get the plan and hopefully adopt it and get moving. So
that's awesome.
With all those different factors, we try to say, let's make the most of this time and help the advisor know their client faster. Mm-hmm.
So what do you do when you have a client and, you know, like you said, and I mean, since we've been money coaching, I realize everyone needs it, right? So once you start talking to
everyone
people, you realize, wow, there's a lot there. There's a lot to unpack and it could be overwhelming. So what does the process look like once you uncover what's going on, whether they're afraid of money or not, whatever it is, whatever their story is, how do you help them? What does that look like?
Yeah, it is. It can be overwhelming, right? Especially if you're starting a process that you've never really experienced mm-hmm. before, yeah. right? Then, and so I always think about this element, which gets into some of the stuff that I wrote in the goals book that just came out a little while ago. It really is about not thinking big, but thinking small. And we so often want to think big when it comes to goals. We want to be able to be that person.
That's my husband, not me, but my husband. I'm all about little small goals.
He wants to make the big declaration.
100%.
We've never gone hiking before, but we're going to climb Mount Everest.
Exactly.
This year,
yes.
Right?
I mean, I'm ready to go around the block, you know?
Right. Exactly. Right. And so, you know, if we think smaller, there's a couple of things that are important with that. So the first thing is it deals with that element of being overwhelmed. We work a lot, to put some context to that, we work a lot with advisors in the coaching side who struggle a lot with widows. Mm-hmm. And widows fire advisors like crazy. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Sexism mm-hmm. is part of it. It is. Another reason for it, though, is a lot of widows, when they were with their significant other, they weren't the household CFO. So they were in exactly what you were talking about. They were overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And so what tends to happen when people are overwhelmed with things, they do what is the exact opposite that you would want them to do. You would want somebody who's overwhelmed, feeling like they have no handle on this, to read as much as they can, to talk to an advisor. If they're overwhelmed with their mm-hmm. physical health, to get a trainer, talk to a doctor. We do the opposite of that. We become money avoidant. Mm-hmm. We don't go to the doctor. Right. We get away from it, right? And so that's part of the other reason why widows fire mm-hmm. advisors. So to fix that, at least to start addressing that, we think smaller. We say, don't talk to a widow or don't talk to someone who's overwhelmed when it comes to their weight or something like that. Let's not talk about 3 years from now. Let's talk about what success will look like this week. Let's talk about just getting to the gym once. I'm not even going to talk about what you need to do there. Let's just get there, right? Mm-hmm. And so those smaller goals are really, really important. And we want to get wins. We want to get wins for that client that feels like they're not in control of their finances and whatnot. And the second piece of that is that we're not wired for goal completion. So in the goals book, there's been a lot of at least some talk that I took a lot of time beating up retirement, mm-hmm. saying that we're not really wired for retirement. Mm-hmm. And the health data on retirement is horrible. So that's mental health and physical health. It's really, really bad. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons, though, relevant to the question we're talking about, people being overwhelmed, is we're not wired for goal completion. we're wired for goal progress. So when we make progress on a goal, we get a little dopamine hit, and it gives us that feel good transmitter, right? We don't get that when we're looking back on our successes. Now, looking back on our successes and looking at a wall of trophies or plaques or whatever, that's great. But what's next? And so when we think about individuals who are overwhelmed, it's important to think about smaller goals. But when we just think about our lives in general, there always should be something else that's next. What's the next step of that? And for people in retirement, I'm not suggesting that if folks are, you know, working hard and their bodies, it's a physically demanding role, that they should keep doing it, but they need to be going to something else because that's just how we're wired.
It's interesting. If you look at the history of retirement, I think it was back in the 1880s, the Kaiser in Germany basically said, we need to create some type of retirement age because we need to get rid of these old people to give young people jobs. And I guess it was okay back then because most people didn't live to be 65 or 70. So they probably passed away before they hit retirement age. And that's the interesting concept right now, where I think people have this fantasy about it. But if you don't have some type of hobbies or some type of way to connect with other people, you do get the retirement. And the interesting thing is, you lived all your life, you've saved up all this money, and you get to a point where you have this net worth. You don't have a net worth problem in retirement, you have a cash flow problem. And these people that have this net worth, they don't want to dip into this net worth because they're scarce. They have that scarcity mindset. But I wanted to ask you, what challenges or what mistakes have you made with money? Because you're the expert here. You've got the systems. I know you got the money scripts. I'm sure you know all about, you know, where have you made mistakes on money? Because for the listeners, they're probably like, Dr. Charles, he knows it all. He's an expert. He's written 9 books. What could he have possibly done wrong with money?
There's nobody that's listening that's saying that. Well, I appreciate that, but you know, it's, you know, I mean, one of the challenges that we all have, and I certainly have, is that element of a present bias. You know, present bias. I mean, retailers, I like to poke fun at Amazon because they're a huge target. I mean, it's so frictionless, right? Yes. To just buy anything. Yes. And so you think about that element that we all deal with. It's like, I can get this right now, like literally right now. This whole idea of saving for the future, I don't know what the future is going to be like. That's too vague. But the right now, it's real. It's going to be here in minutes delivered to me. So, you know, I deal with that all the time. And I think, you know, for all of us, it's that element of, you know, the famous psychologist, you know, of the last century, Jung, talked about the idea of knowing our shadows, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing the things that get in the way of us he was talking about being a good person. You can't be a good person unless you really understand what the bad parts of you are. I'll water that down of what Jung said. But I think that is true when it comes to all of us, understanding what are the things that really get in the way of us meeting our goals. And thinking about that to the advisors that are listening, the best thing we could do for clients is say, okay, here's the plan. Now tell me 3 things that'll get in the way of that. And let's address it right now. So that when they come, we don't abandon the whole thing, right? The weight loss is always a great example, because if you say, well, you know what, I know you're going to plateau around the holidays. Don't worry about it. It's going to be great when we hit January 2nd. They do all this work for the weight loss up to the holidays and it plateaus. The likelihood that that person's going to stick with the plan goes way up. I expected this. I knew this was going to happen. I'm back on the horse January 2nd. And so understanding not only what our biases or our mistakes that we made are important, but saying, okay, here's the things that could get in the way of that. And I'm not going to panic when they come. I have a plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that.
I mean, that's just life in general, right? Some of us are perfectionists, not me. I'm looking over at my husband. And I think even with our kids, you know, we have 6 children, and it's hard to watch them be afraid or to make a mistake with money, with life, whatever it is. And just to encourage, yeah, you're going to mess up and that's okay. And with money, the same thing, you will make, in my husband's scenario, a bad deal.
Or two.
And that's, but the whole point is it stings, it hurts, you lose something, but that's where that's where your life lessons are, that you need them. You need those stories behind you. And I think that's just an encouragement for everyone listening is that, yes, no, you, I think we know, like you mentioned, weight loss, eating healthy, all of those things. For me personally, I already know why I'll stop. I already know why. I already know the reason. I pretend I don't know it.
Right.
And so I love that you asked those questions, because now I'm just revealing what I already know and what my excuse will be. Now I'm letting you know that now you're going to hold me accountable, which is wonderful.
Yeah, well, and you're going to hold yourself accountable,
yes,
too, right?
100%.
I mean, which is a bigger part of it. I mean, I think that element of regret is, mm-hmm. you know, those mistakes. And a lot of times, you know, I mean, you reference children, you know, especially parents now, in a lot of cases, don't let their kids fail.
Right.
And, you know, if you think about any parts of your life where things have happened, where you have failed, I mean, I look back on, you asked me about my failures. I look back at the things that I failed at so far, and they've made me the person I am now.
Right.
And they make me more accepting of other people's shortcomings and whatnot, because I went through that myself. So mm-hmm. you think about a life that is free of failure. I'm not exactly sure that's a well-lived life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would also argue that somebody who's free of failure is not challenging themselves. Mm. Right. I mean, losing is okay. And as long as you're taking something from it, I'm not suggesting that people should have frivolous goals.
Right.
And obviously I'm not saying that, mm-hmm. but that element of losing is, there's power in it. One of my favorite writings, I guess you could call it a poem, is Teddy Roosevelt's Man in the Arena. And I basically live my life on that. You know, Teddy Roosevelt basically said that, you know, it's not the person that's sitting in the audience who's jeering. It's the person in the arena. And if you're in the arena, whether you win or lose, that's where you are. Mm-hmm. You're there and you're fighting the good fight. Sometimes you win and sometimes you don't. But I identify with that, because I would rather be the person in the arena than the person in the stands that's pointing my finger saying, I could do that better. That's mm-hmm. not a full life to me. Mm-hmm. And so when you are the person in the arena, failure is possible, and that's okay.
Yeah. But real quick, Gina, I just want to go. I want to continue this for a second. What is your thoughts on people that are afraid to make mistakes? They're afraid. What is it? Is it something that they were never, even as a young person, you know, we were talking about our kids, maybe they weren't, if they made a mistake, there would be a serious consequence. And so therefore they always played it safe. Do you know what I mean? Like what, right. what's behind that?
Well, I mean, it is part of how we're raised. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's certainly when you think about, I mean, if you like with standardized tests, you know, if you, the students, it is, even undergrads that I teach, it is really like, I don't need to know the backstory. Just tell me if I'm right or not.
Yes.
That's all I want to know. Right. Mm-hmm. And there really isn't that gray area. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think, by the way, you know, sports and arts education are so powerful in helping with that, right? Because first of all, with arts education, you really go through a process of something, and a process that's not gonna happen in 5 seconds or 10 minutes. It could be months if you're sculpting and you, mm-hmm. you know, over the course of time, as you chisel that sculpture, different moves that you make are good and some are not good. And you look at that and you reflect on what you did and you slowly get something to where you want it to be. And in sports, you're getting feedback all the time, and that's great. And you're going to lose. There's two teams on the field.
Yeah. Right.
You're going to lose. The Knicks played here last night and one team won and one team lost. There, you got a 50% chance of losing.
Right.
But the Cubs half empty. Thank goodness the Knicks won, by the way. But, I think that it's ingrained in us. I think also there's an element of identity and pride that comes from us wanting to be that person that's correct all the time. And there's beauty in being wrong. I mean, think about people that you interact with about it. You know, obviously politics comes up all the time, but for people to stand up and say about whether it's politics, whether it's some element of parenting or whether it's money, think about people that you've been around that stand up and say, you know what, after consideration, I was wrong.
Mm.
I have incredible respect for people that do that. So, you know, I really thought this was the correct course of action, but because of this, this, and this, I was wrong. And I think sometimes we don't, we don't celebrate that enough.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. But also, finally, I guess the final element to answer your question is we need to create environments where being wrong isn't the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And that happens, you know, think about organizations and employers being wrong. Say, you know what, here's, I was wrong and here's why. We learned something as an organization that is great value for us. And so whether it's in a school or whether it's at work or in our own personal finances, that element of being wrong, it's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's why I have a problem with school because it's like right and wrong. Well, I want to know what I did wrong and how to fix it. You know what I mean? And that's, so of course we homeschooled so all our years because my kids are like, is this cheating if I'm looking at how to do it?
But well, no,
I want you to learn
things, yes.
How to do it properly. And if you did something wrong, there's one part you did it wrong. Let's find that one area and work on it.
Yeah, and you're talking about process. That's right. And that's exactly right. Right, the element of process over product.
Right.
Right. With a great process, we'll get to the product. There could be five other factors that get in the way of the ideal product, but a good process from a learning perspective is everything.
Yeah.
It's everything.
Yeah, agreed.
It's interesting. I'll bring in the story. You were talking about the arts. When I started singing opera, I remember in the beginning, it was very challenging and it was hard. And now with the implementation of AI and with the ease of way to do things, for you to learn a skill like that, you have to really struggle. You know, if you don't have that growth mindset where you're saying, I'm a beginner, I have to start from the beginning. I may sound terrible, but if I practice every week and I do my scales and I learn how to breathe and it may take some time, and that's just like with any skill in life. That comes down to learning about money. That comes to learn about hitting a baseball, shooting a bat. And that's the challenging part where in the book, The Gold Standard, you talk about the goal, which is the result, but fall in love with the system or the process. But I'm going with this somewhere because this is important because you both missed this element, but I'm going to add it in, baby. It's about the identity, which you talk about, that if you don't identify as somebody who is in your instance, someone who is responsible with money, you're not going to stop swiping on Amazon because that's not your identity. And let's talk about that identity piece because that's very important because I want people to think that we are not brought into this world knowing anything about money. There's no shame in not knowing about money because we were never taught about money. But we can adopt the identity to become better with money if we spend the time to learn about what actually money is.
That's right. I mean, so not only are we not taught, but we're not even really wired for saving and investing. I mean, we're wired for hunting and gathering. We're wired for instant gratification. So all of those, it's very instinctual for us to have instant gratification, right? That's part of it. Identity is a big part of goals. I mean, one of the reasons why I wrote that book, obviously I wanted to help advisors and clients, but I just find that there are a lot of people who climb corporate ladders because the next rung up seems like a good idea. And they take years and sometimes decades to climb a ladder that they don't even want to be on.
Yes.
And I have incredible sympathy for those people. And so I wrote this book to say, to look at all processes of goals. So goal completion, yeah, is part of it, of course, and setting goals and all that stuff is important. But identity, what is it that you would be doing if no one was looking? What is it if you were by yourself for a year and you had to pick something to learn or do and you couldn't tell anyone about it? What is it that you would be doing? And so many people would have a different answer than what it is that they're actually doing. Now, there's other factors involved in that. People feed families, people have responsibilities. But that element of identity is a critical part. And we can also shape our identity. Our identity is much more malleable than people think. If you are somebody, going back to fitness, who has struggled with being in shape and has struggled working out, you can create that identity through small goals of being, I am a runner. I'm a runner because I am starting a process. I'm joining a running group. I'm going on the running track every day. Now you're a runner. And that identity starts saying, okay, I'm a runner. Suddenly, after a few months of that, when you're not running, something's wrong. Now you're hooked. Now we're getting into habit formation and whatnot, which is really, really powerful. So it really is that element of of thinking about your identity and thinking what is it that works for you? And we really kind of talk about a lot of work that in all these books and even in our financial planning program really ties into something called self-determination theory. And self-determination theory is a few decades old. It was started by a couple of guys named Desi and Ryan. And basically, to boil it down, self-determination theory really means that we are wired to have three innate needs. Now, you think about others like Maslow's hierarchy. This would be similar to that. Maslow's hierarchy is helpful, but what I like about this self-determination theory is saying that we have three innate needs, and they are this. We want to be competent. We want to be able to do whatever it is we need to do to be successful, to function, right? We want to be autonomous. We want to be able to make decisions over our current and future well-being. And we want to be connected. We want to be connected to something larger than ourselves. That could be through our community. It could be through our church or synagogue. It could be through our school. It could be through our relationships and or all of those things. And so when one of those things is off or missing, then we tend to be a lot more susceptible to things like FOMO. We tend to go to social media and we start seeing other people posting things, whether it's a crypto gain or a vacation or whatever it might be. And we start feeling like something's missing for us, right? Mm-hmm. We start spending more time on that. We start looking for external validation or posting more. And now it's the analogy of somebody who's thirsty and they're drinking salt water and they're drinking mm-hmm. more and more of it. And so really having those three and eight needs satisfied. And we actually look at that. We look at FOMO in MRI. We actually measure it from two perspectives, both FOMO, life FOMO, but also financial FOMO. And because if an advisor knows that, then it's really helpful to say, okay, look, we got a great plan here. You're happy about this plan? Yes. Well, okay. That remember that people could be posting that they're going to be getting these huge gains. No, the people that are getting the huge losses aren't posting about that. So, right. You know, so, but that element of those three and eight needs can be really helpful both for us, but also for advisors and other individuals.
I need to repeat them again. And I want you to write this down when you listen, as you're listening to this. The first one is being competent. The second one is autonomous. And the third one is connected. And shame on me for not ever hearing this. I don't know why I've never heard of this, but this makes so much sense to me because I want to be good at what I'm doing. I want to be able to make my own decisions. And I want to be connected with whether I'm creating a community or my family or whatever. And it makes so much sense to me because that's why I strove to quote unquote become financially independent because I wanted that autonomy. I didn't want the money. I wanted what the money allowed me to do. And the money can allow me to be, you know, if I'm competent, I'm probably making money. If I'm making money, I'm probably going to be autonomous. And then I'm going to be connected if I've got some extra free time where I can go out and connect with others. So it's very interesting how it's circular, how it sort of connects. You're not impressed by that, are you? You're just sitting there going,
no, I'm just listening. I was thinking it's funny, though, incredible. At the same time, we naturally live this, right? Like we don't even, it's, yes, I know you've never heard it before.
I know, yes. I've never explained it to me that simply.
It's when you feel at peace, right? It's like, oh, okay, everything feels
it's
right.
All clicking, baby. Yes. Yes.
So go back to the retiree. So the retiree who was in a career or a job for 35 years identifies as an accountant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And is connected through sees coworkers every day for 40 hours a week. Suddenly now they're no longer an accountant.
Right.
Okay. And they're no longer connected to their fellow employees. Okay. So if they're no longer an accountant, what are they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now I'm not asking that. That's what they're asking, right? What am I?
Yeah.
What am I? And it could be that they're a grandparent. It could be that they're a deacon in their church. It could be it could be any number. And all those things work, right? Yep. But for so many other people, it's I got this number and now I'm cashing out. And they sit there and go, what am I now? And what mm-hmm. about these three elements that are part of who I am?
That's why it's important that you're creating the plan. But you're creating the plan. If you're telling your financial your advisor you want to retire at 62, he or she is going to create that plan that you're telling them. So be sure that's what you want. That's why you need to do the work that Dr. Charles is talking about, because that's not what you may ultimately want. You may want to still be competent, autonomous, and connected as you retire. And your retirement may look like, hey, I'm going to work 10 hours as a CPA, and I'm going to devote the other 30 hours to going to community college and teaching. Maybe that's what the plan may look like.
Is that what you're doing?
No, that's not. Oh. Yeah, I'm actually.
For a second, I got nervous.
I'm going to start doing
like
that.
He's going to get another thing to do. No, I think so. At your point, you have a lot of people retired. You use that word a couple of times, and I remember when we moved to Florida, my husband, I think for a second, thought he was going to retire down here. I think it lasted a couple of days and he just was painfully bored. But I think we also get into that mentality of parents. I know a lot of moms that once their kids, are 18, they move to college, they don't come back. Their identity, they have no idea who they are, because right. their motherhood was their identity for so long that they don't know it. They're just lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that element of being challenged, it goes back to that, what we were talking about earlier about that fear of failure. The people who are, my dad, as a car person, right, would mm-hmm. go test drive a car. This is the best analogy I could give. And he would test drive a car and he would, it's always the same thing. He'd be on a freeway and he'd floor it. Well, let's see what this baby can do. And the reason why I bring that up here is because so many people aren't hitting their accelerator. Mm. See what it is that you can do. And you pick what it is. But where is it that you're... And for some people, look, there's a lot of people out there that are listening to this they have two jobs and they're struggling to... Mm-hmm. Their accelerator is down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I understand that. Yes. And celebrate and appreciate that. But for so many other people... Where are you getting pushed? Where's that challenge? That challenge of, and we talk about that state of flow. A state of mm-hmm. flow basically psychologically is that I am in something I really want to be in. I am all of my efforts and cognitive energies and maybe even physical energies are focused on this. That's what I'm on. I'm totally mm-hmm. in that state of being challenged. And mm-hmm. so for some people, I think there's just value in saying, where are you at with your accelerator? Mm-hmm. And when you're retired or something like that, whether it's starting a new business or being more involved in something else. And there's some people, by the way, that retire to what their identity is. So we talked about the bad side. There's a lot of people that say, you know what? I've always been whatever it might be. I worked 30 years to raise my family. And now that I've done that, I can retire and be who I am. And that's success. Right. That's awesome. So I don't want to make it sound like these are all, there's lots of success stories that comes to that. But I just find that value for people that I just find it incredibly powerful. Here in New York, we have people that come here to New York to be on Broadway or to be in show business, and they mm-hmm. just come and do it. And most of them fail. But when I meet some of them, I have such respect for that. You tried it. You tried
100%.
It. That's right. Go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. I think we were made for so much that I was going to say we were made for so much more than retirement, but the retirement that I'm talking about, which is that I'm lost. I don't know. I worked really hard. Now my identity, I don't know who I am. I just, what's your, I need, my husband has the best wrapped up. So
oh, as far as, I'm going to wrap up the show, but I do, Dr. Charles, you've written 9 books.
I just want to point out 9 books.
Yeah. The thing is, you said there's no goal attainment. You've attained the 9. I know you've already got something rumbling in your head. What's the next publication?
Well, I didn't say that there wasn't goal attainment. There is goal attainment. But what I'm saying is that we're not wired to sit back and just stare at, I'm not wired to just sit and stare at these books I've done.
Yes. Right.
So what? Yes. Right. Yeah. But it's like the next one, right?
What's the next one?
Yeah. So So I have a book that is, we just released the second issue of Psychology of Financial Planning. So that's been a big undertaking. We just released it a week ago. And so there's been a lot involved with that, which has been great. I do a money behavior LinkedIn newsletter. I'm looking at maybe, I had a podcast before. I may be bringing that back. to focus on that as well. And then I've got Numb that I may be updating. We'll see.
All right.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there.
You see what I mean? I knew it, baby.
I love it. I love it.
For someone who's thinking about retirement, that does not look like retirement at all. That's great. That's excellent. What I love about the podcast, my wife loves the wrap up, so she's really putting the pressure on me to wrap this baby up. But for me, the one word that was really cool what we started out with was the word attention. And I think it's important where you put your attention to is what you value. And I think it's really important to reclaim some of that time back and start creating the values for yourself. I think the whole process from the book, The Goal Standard, is incredible. It's actually a very well-written book in the format that it is more, there's more science-based, there's more research in it, and yet there's a ton of stories in it, and it's very applicable. And what I like about it, there's exercises at the end of each chapter. So you literally sit down and you do exercises and you work on it. It's not just a read book, it's actually a do book, and that's how you do it. I like the framework of goals, the result, systems, processes, the identity. That's really important. But ultimately, what I love about what you guys are doing with the work is I personally think that you're at the forefront of psychology and the relationship that people have with money. And that money is really important, but it ultimately isn't the root cause. It's usually something that's systemic or that's behavioral that's going on. And it's your job, Dr. Charles, or the financial planner's job to delve in a little bit deeper, to ask the right questions, and to be an intimate listener, to give yourself, to give all of your attention to somebody, to be able to listen to them, to say, oh, I hear you. Is this what you want? And then to challenge them and to create a specific blueprint or a plan. So the idea of financial planning 30 years ago is completely dead on arrival today. You want a financial planner that is an advocate for you, that will listen to you, that will challenge you, and that will give you the space, but you want one that keeps you radically accountable, that one that makes you relentlessly execute on the plan, and the one that will just be there and be listening for you and be an advocate for you.
I mean, all those attributes of a planner you described, that's a coach, right? That's what the coaching element is. And I guess the final thing I would say about that is it really is like for your listeners that are thinking about, I guess going back to retirement, that element of specificity, right? So if I go work with a firm, I talk to advisors and say, okay, you ask a client, there's two ways you could handle it. One is, what do you want your retirement to look like? That's great. But a lot of times people haven't even thought about it, so they don't really have a good answer. The better, going back to use the word specific in there, specificity is, what's a Tuesday morning in your retirement going to look like? Who are you going to be with? Where are you going to be? What's going to bring you joy? What's going to challenge you? And be specific on that.
Are we getting together Tuesday? No,
it's Tuesday morning. That's what I'm saying. I know where I am Tuesday morning. I'm having breakfast with the wife in the backyard. I love that. Dr. Charles, where can the listeners get a hold of you?
So you can find me at charleschafin.com and whatnot. I'm LinkedIn also works too. You can check out all the podcasts and all that stuff we got there. But please connect.
Awesome.
Thanks, Dr. Charles. We want to thank the listeners for spending part of their day with us. We are Gino and Julia Barbaro of Barbaro 360, and we will see you on next week's show. Thanks, everyone.